And when that gels, there's only one solution: head knocking collision. And the communists will take it over. Rhodes' plans received a terrible blow in 1890. When Lord Salisbury sought to end the African disputes with Germany and Portugal by delimiting their territorial claims in South and East Africa, the Portuguese agreement of 1891 was never ratified, but the Anglo-German agreement of 1890 blocked Rhodes' route to Egypt by extending German East Africa, Tanganyika, west to the Belgian Congo. By the same agreement, Germany abandoned Nyasaland, Uganda, and Zanzibar to Britain in return for the island of Heligoland in the Baltic Sea and an advantageous boundary in German Southwest Africa. They just played checkers with it. Now remember, the Boers are down here, the Dutch. I'm getting there. As soon as the German agreement was published, Lugard was sent by the British East Africa Company to overcome the resistance of native chiefs and slavers in Uganda. The bankruptcy of this company in 1895 seemed likely to lead to the abandonment of Uganda because of the Little Englander sentiment in the Liberal Party, which was in office for 3 years, 1892 to 1895. Rhodes offered to take the area over himself and run it for £25,000 a year, but was refused. As a result of complex and secret negotiations in which Lord Rosebery was the chief figure, Britain kept Uganda. Rhodes was made a privy councillor. Rosebery replaced his father-in-law, Lord Rothschild, in Rhodes' secret group and was made a trustee under Rhodes' next and last will. Rosebery tried to obtain a route for Rhodes' railway to the north across the Belgian Congo. Rosebery was informed of Rhodes' plans to finance an uprising of the English within the Transvaal, Boer Republic. Wait a minute, you want me to do that again? Rosebery was informed of Rhodes' plan to finance an uprising of the English within the Transvaal Boer Republic and to send Dr. Jameson on a raid into that country to restore order. You want me to read that again? Rosebery was informed of Rhodes' plans to finance an uprising of the English within the Transvaal Boer Republic, where the Dutch were, and to send Dr. Jameson on a raid into that country to restore order. Create an uprising so you can send Jameson to restore it. And finally, Rhodes found the money to finance Kitchener's railway from Egypt to Uganda using the South African gauge and engines given by Rhodes. The economic strength which allowed Rhodes to do these things rested in his diamond and gold mines, the latter in the Transvaal, the Dutch Boer Republic, and thus not in British territory. North of Cape Colony, across the Orange River, was a Boer Republic, the Orange Free State. Beyond this, and separated by the Vaal River, was another Boer Republic, the Transvaal. Beyond this, across the Limpopo River, was, and continuing northward to the Zambezi, was the savage native kingdom of the Matabeles. With great personal daring, unscrupulous opportunism, and extravagant expenditure of money, Rhodes obtained an opening to the north, passing west of the Boer Republics by getting British control of Griqualand West, Bechuanaland, and the Bechuanaland Protectorate. Still playing chess. In 1888, Rhodes... I wish I could get a bunch of these books for our church. In 1888, Rhodes obtained a vague but extensive mining concession from the Matabeles chief, Lobengula, and gave it to the British South Africa Company organized for the purpose. Rhodes obtained a charter so worded that the company had very extensive powers in an area without any northern limits beyond Bechuanaland Protectorate. 4 years later, the Matabeles were attacked and destroyed by Dr. Jameson, and their lands taken by the company. It had nothing to do with race. It didn't have a damn thing to do with race. It's the strong and the weak. It wouldn't have mattered if they were Germans, Dutch, Chinese, black, yellow, green, or blue. His economic purposes to gain power for the English-speaking people by hook or crook
was the issue.
Their lands were taken to the company. The company, however, was not a commercial success. I think, has the cooler come on? Or has it just got later? The company, however, was not a commercial success. Paid no dividends for 35 years up until 1924. And only 12 and a half shillings in 46 years. Want me to quit? This compares with 793.5% dividends paid by Rhodes Consolidated Gold Fields in the 5 years, 1889 to 1894, and the 125% dividend it paid in 1896. Most of the South Africa Company's money was used on public improvements like roads and schools, and no rich mines were found in its territory, known as Rhodesia, compared to those further south in the Transvaal. Now you're going to find this hard to believe. In spite of the terms of the Rhodes Wills, Rhodes himself was not a racist, nor was he a political Democrat. He worked as easily and as closely with Jews, black natives, or Boers as he did with English. But he had a passionate belief in the value of a liberal education and was attached to a restricted suffrage and even to a non-secret ballot. In South Africa, he was a staunch friend of the Dutch and of the blacks, found his chief political support among the Boers until at least 1895, and wanted restrictions on natives put on an educational rather than a color basis. These ideas have generally been held by his group since and have played an important part in British imperial history. His greatest weakness rested on the fact that his passionate attachment to his goals made him overly tolerant in regard to methods. Quickly, he's being nice. He didn't hesitate to use either bribery or force to attain his ends if he judged they would be effective. This weakness led to his greatest errors. The Jameson Raid of 1895 and the Boer War of 1899 to 1902. Errors which were disastrous for the future of the empire he loved. Now we're getting close. Shall I go on? By 1895, South Africa. By 1895, the Transvaal Republic presented an acute problem. All political control was in the hands of a rural, backward, Bible-reading, racist minority of Boers, while all economic wealth was in the hands of a violent, aggressive majority of foreigners, wheatlanders, most of whom lived in the new city of Johannesburg. The wheatlanders, who were twice as numerous as the Boers and owned 2/3 of the land and 9/10 of the wealth of the country, were prevented from participating in the political life or from becoming citizens, except after 14 years' residence, and were irritated by a series of minor pinpricks and extortions, such as tax differentials, a dynamite monopoly, and transportation restrictions, and by rumors that the Transvaal president, Paul Kruger, was intriguing to obtain some kind of German intervention and protection. What's this got to do with blacks? This is whites versus whites now, right? At this point in 1895, Rhodes made his plans to overthrow Kruger's government by an uprising in Johannesburg, financed by himself and Beit, and led by his brother, Frank Rhodes, Abe Bailey, and other supporters. When this uprising occurred, it was to be followed by an invasion of the Transvaal, led by a force under Jameson, from Bechuanaland in Rhodesia. Flora Shaw used the Times to prepare public opinion in England. While Albert Gray and others negotiated with Colonial Secretary Joseph Chamberlain for the official support that was necessary. Unfortunately, when the revolt fizzled out in Johannesburg, Jameson raided anyway in an effort to revive it, and was easily captured by the Boers. Now what? Now what? Now what? You want me to continue?
Yes, sir.
We're getting right down to the background now. The public officials involved denounced the plot, loudly proclaimed their surprise at the event, and were able to whitewash most of the participants in the subsequent parliamentary inquiry. A telegram from the German Kaiser to President Kruger of the Transvaal, congratulating him on his success in preserving the independence of his country without the need to call for aid from his friends, was billed up by the Times as an example of brazen German interference in British affairs, and almost eclipsed Jameson's aggression. Rhodes was stopped only temporarily, but he had lost the support of many of the Boers. For almost 2 years, he and his friends stayed quiet, waiting for the storm to blow over. Then they began to act again. Propaganda, most of it true, about the plight of the Wheatlanders in the Transvaal Republic, flooded England and South Africa from Flora Shaw, W.T. Stead, Edmund Garrett, and others, using the Times. The plight of the Wheatlanders in Johannesburg. Milner was made High Commissioner of South Africa. Brett worked his way into the confidence of the monarchy to become its chief political advisor during a period of more than 25 years. He wrote almost daily letters of advice to King Edward during his reign. By a process whose details are still obscure, a brilliant young graduate of Cambridge, Jan Smuts, who had been a vigorous supporter of Rhodes and acted as his agent in Kimberley as late as 1895, and who was one of the most important members of the Rhodes-Milner Group in the period 1908 to 1950, went to the Transvaal. And by violent anti-British agitation, became the state secretary of that country, although a British subject and chief political advisor to President Kruger of the Transvaal, Boer Independent Republic. Milner made provocative troop movements on the Boer frontiers in spite of the vigorous protests of his commanding general in South Africa. You know, I have one of the world's collections of Boer War correspondents. A real interesting night is sitting and reading the soldiers' letters. I'm serious. Milner made provocative troop movements on the Boer frontiers. Remember the old bald-headed preacher, Jack White, that I used to tell you about, that used to be very demonstrative? Knocked on his pulpit one night to demonstrate the devil trying to get into your heart or something like that. No, I guess it was Jesus knocking at the door. Yeah, there is a difference. There's a little old girl about 2 years old in the back, says, "Come in!" And he slapped his bald head and said, "She just ruined my message." He fought. He not only sailed in the old sailing vessels, but he fought in the Boer War. He said that they had natives fighting on their side. He used to tell tales how they'd kill a cow and have a feast, and they had to eat all of it. And they would take tallow and rub it on their stomach to try to stretch the muscles as they'd gorge themselves. And then when they got the point they just couldn't eat anymore, apparently there's some reason why they had to eat it all, you know, religious or something. They would then borrow soap from the Boer War or the British soldiers and eat the soap until they could heave their insides out and vacate the space and then start all over again. I mean, he used to regale me by the hour with Boer War tales, and that's what got me into collecting Boer War correspondence. I just threw that in. Milner made... I didn't throw it up in. Miller made provocative troop movements on the Boer frontiers in spite of the vigorous protests of his commanding general in South Africa, who had to be removed. And finally, war was precipitated when Smuts drew up an ultimatum insisting that the British troop movements cease. And when this was rejected by Milner, the Boer War, 1899 to 1902, was one of the most important events in British imperial history. The ability of 40,000 Boer farmers to hold off 400,000, or 10 times as many British, for 3 years, inflicting a series of defeats on them over that period, destroyed faith in British power. Although the Boer republics were defeated and annexed in 1902, Britain's confidence was so shaken that it made a treaty with Japan in the same year, providing that if either signer became engaged in war with two enemies in the Far East, the other signer would come to the rescue. This treaty, which allowed Japan to attack Russia in 1904, lasted for 20 years, being extended to the Middle East in 1912. At the same time, Germany's obvious sympathy with the Boers, combined with the German naval construction program of 1900, alienated the British people from the Germans and contributed greatly toward the Anglo-French Entente of 1904. Milner took over the two defeated Boer republics and administered them as occupied territory until 1905, using a civil service of young men recruited for the purpose. This group, known as Milner's Kindergarten, reorganized the government and administration of the Transvaal and Orange River Colony and played a major role in South African life generally. When Milner left public life in 1905 to devote himself to international finance and the Rhodes Enterprises, Lord Selborne, his successor as High Commissioner, took over the kindergarten and continued to use it. In 1906, a new liberal government in London granted self-government to the two Boer states. The kindergarten spent the next 4 years in a successful effort to create a South African Federation. The task was not an easy one, even with such powerful backing as Selborne. Smuts, who was now the dominant political figure in the Transvaal, although Botha held the position of Prime Minister, and Jameson, who was the Prime Minister of the Cape Colony in 1904 to 1908. The subject was broached through a prearranged public interchange of letters between Jameson and Selborne. Then Selborne published a memorandum written by Philip Kerr and Lionel Curtis calling for a union of the four colonies. Kerr founded a periodical, The State. Remember, Curtis was the one that said, give them power for their fit. Kerr founded a periodical, The State, financed by Sir Abe Bailey, who seemed to have as inexhaustible resources as Rhodes, which advocated federation in every issue. Curtis and others scurried about organizing closer union societies. Robert H. Lord Brand and Sir Patrick Duncan laid the groundwork for the new constitution. At the Durban Constitutional Convention, where Duncan and B.K. Long were legal advisors, the Transvaal delegation was controlled by Smuts and the kindergarten. This delegation, which was heavily financed, tightly organized, knew exactly what it wanted, dominated the convention, wrote the constitution for the Union of South Africa, and succeeded in having it ratified in 1910. Local animosities were compromised in a series of ingenious arrangements, including one by which the legislative, executive, and judicial branches of the new government were placed in three different cities. Now, let me start throwing the strings together. We got a bunch of idiots here in America that look through one set of glasses and judge the world by that standard. It's been over 100 years since the Civil War healed the breach between the South and the North. But we still hear. Most of us here can remember when Wallace was screaming states' rights. The Lone Star State didn't become a part of the Union overnight. But the United States did develop with a kind of consistency and consecutive expansion. The United States was not formed as a loose confederation of powerful separate unions who decided South Africa was formed with a mini United Nations. They didn't develop as we developed into a union consecutively. They were divided at war. If we had extended our control over Texas and California to a claim over Mexico, you'd have an analogy. And if some American Union had been formed with the compromises of South Africa, we might have an analogy. The local animosities were compromised in a series of ingenious arrangements. We formed a country with a well-thought-out constitution, with a balance of power between the executive, legislative, and judicial branches. Here is a compromise union of necessity where the give and take and local animosities were settled by the legislative, executive, and judicial branches of the new government being placed in three different cities. If they can't get along, we put the executive branch in Washington, the judicial branch in Houston, the executive branch, what did I say Washington was? Legislative? Executive? Legislative branch in San Francisco. At a time when there wasn't the travel accommodations of now, that was 1910. A trip to the different cities was a big effort. The country began eclectically divided with deep-seated animosities, much broader than mere black versus white. The Rhodes-Milner Group recognized that Boer, Dutch, nationalism and color intolerance were threats to the future stability and loyalty of South Africa. But they had faith in the political influence of Smuts and Botha, of Rhodes' allies, and of the four members of the kindergarten who stayed in South Africa to hold off these problems until time could moderate the irreconcilable Boers. In this they were mistaken, because as men like Jameson, Botha, Duncan, Long, and Smuts died off, they were not replaced by men of equal loyalty and ability, with the result that the Boer extremists under D.F. Malan came to power in 1948. The first cabinet of the Union of South Africa was formed in 1910 by the South African Party, which was largely Boer, with Louis Botha as prime minister. The real master of the government was Smuts, who held 3 out of 9 portfolios, all important ones, and completely dominated Botha. Their policy of reconciliation with the English and of loyal support for the British connection was violently opposed by the Boer nationalists within the party led by J.B.M. Herzog. Herzog was eager to get independence from Britain and to reserve political control in a South African public to Boers only. He obtained growing support by agitating on the language and educational issues, insisting that all government officials must speak Afrikaans, and that it be a compulsory language in schools, with English a voluntary second language. That's one of the issues right now in the education area that caused one of the riots when they dropped English as one of the voluntary languages to be taught at all in the black subdivisions. The opposition party, am I boring you? As unionists, was largely English and was led by Jameson, supported by Duncan, Richard Feedham, Hugh Wyndham, and Long. Financed by Milner's allies and the Rhodes Trust, its leaders considered that their chief task was to support the prime minister against the extremists of his own party. Long, as the best speaker, was ordered to attack Herzog constantly. When Herzog struck back with too violent language in 1912, he was dropped from the cabinet and soon seceded from the South African party, joining with the irreconcilable Boer Republicans like Christian De Wet to form the Nationalist Party. The new party adopted an extreme anti-English and anti-native platform, and I'm telling you, if these sanctions go through, that Nationalist Party will take over. the extreme right, Jameson's party, under his successor, Sir Thomas Smart, a paid agent of the Rhodes Organization, had dissident elements because of the growth of white labor unions, which insisted on anti-native legislation. Now enter the labor unions. The white labor unions are not against the blacks because the blacks are black. They're against the blacks because they don't want to share the jobs. That's all. You want me to quit? Or can you survive this? I don't want to have to lead up. You know how long it'll take me to review up to this part if I have to do it again some other time? Just help me get through it and then listen to it on reruns when you're awake. What's the matter with you? I've had as little sleep as all of you, and I'll be up as early as all of you. I'm as old as most of you. By 1914, this party, Jameson's party, that had dissident elements because of the growth of white labor unions, which insisted on anti-native legislation, by 1914, these formed a separate labor party under F.H.P. Creswell. And were able to win from Smuts a law excluding natives from most semi-skilled or skilled work or any high-paying positions. The natives were compelled to work for wages, however low, by the need to obtain cash for taxes and by the inadequacy of the native reserves to support them from their own agricultural activities. By the Land Act of 1913, about 7% of the land area was reserved for future land purchases by natives, and another 93% for purchases by whites. Now, be a white liberal in South Africa today. You probably weren't alive in 1913. I wasn't. 7% of the land was set aside. Blacks could own there and coloreds could own there. 93% of the land was reserved for purchase by the whites. That's wrong. Dead wrong. But don't shoot a six-month-old white baby born in 1985 because of it. We've got their attention and they know they're going to have to change. But the revolution's going to come. It'll be owned by the new government. It'll all be reserved for the government, the communist government, who know what's best for all of them. As a result of such discriminations, the wages of natives were about one-tenth those of whites. That's wrong. This discrepancy in remuneration permitted white workers to earn salaries comparable to those earned in North America, although the national income was low and productivity per capita was very low. The Botha-Smuts government of 1910 to 1924 did little to cope with the almost insoluble problems which faced South Africa. I had somebody call me the other night and say, I'm against what Dr. Scott's proposing. Give them time. They've had 300 years of time and done nothing. That's a real brilliant historical statement. 300 years. 1586. They didn't get there till 1624. And some people wonder why I'm intolerant of ignorance.